Welcome then to Discovery 1, Chapter 9, Troubleshooting Your Network.
If anybody wants to take their finals, get in touch with me. I'm not sure if Nehemiah's going to be able to do anything, but if you email Discovery Instructors if you're ready to take your final, give us 2 days' notice, and then I'll catch up with you and we'll get finals going. And other than that, just keep the labs coming in for those who are not caught up. We'll see if we can get all the labs in. And that's pretty much it.
What's the class deadline for people who need to know?
I think it's January.
Okay.
I think it's like the 31st.
Yeah, I think it's probably like I don't know.
That can be shifted nearer if we need.
Can it?
Yeah, you can change it. But we need to be clear on when the course deadline is. The course deadline like December 1st, like it is for the Indian class, because that way everybody's got a target to work towards. So you've got to be done by December 1st. Is that what we want to do?
It's fairly reasonable.
Yeah, I'm thinking December. Yeah, I'm thinking December 1st. That'll give a month beyond the lectures to get labs and exams and all done. So I'm thinking that should be a fairly good timetable. But I'll put it out in the announce mailing list.
For people in ITE who are listening to this, don't panic. Your deadline is not December 1st at all. Nowhere near it. You've got till sometime in January.
But if you are in Discovery, now would be a good time to start panicking. I mean, working towards getting your labs done.
End of announcement. Now I can turn it over to Aiden for the rest of the lecture.
Okay. So, does anybody, before we start, does anybody have any questions about class-related stuff?
Not for me.
Okay, I'll take that. Okay, I'll take that as a no. So, welcome then to Discovery 1, Chapter 9, Troubleshooting Your Network. And this chapter teaches, as the title said, how to troubleshoot your network and how to recognize and correct the causes of common network problems. It starts with a slideshow diagram. Just a moment while things get into focus. So there's a slideshow diagram basically saying that our human network communicates 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. We're constantly working, collaborating, learning, and playing together over the network, and we rely on our networks to be available when we need them, whatever day or hour we need them. So, of course, it's critical that network connectivity and services be restored of a failure. I mean, just 10 minutes ago, I was logging into my National Library site, and it's very nice that that site's up. If some administrator had been put his coffee down on the computer's off button and the site had gone down, I would not have been very happy. So the first section, 9.1, is the troubleshooting process. Troubleshooting is, well, can anyone define it?
A systematic approach to diagnosing and resolving problems with anything.
Yeah, in this case, obviously, it's with networks, but yeah, troubleshooting is a good systematic way of solving any type of problems. Experienced individuals often rely on instinct to troubleshoot. However, there are structured techniques that can most probable cause. Am I breaking up for anybody?
Just a little bit.
Absolutely not.
You need to speak up a little bit.
Or,
and keep
or drop your sensitivity.
Yeah, or drop it some more.
Give it another 5% and you should be...
Okay, I'll do just that. Okay, let's see if this actually keeps on without without cutting off for a time. Yes, it seems to be. Good. So, when troubleshooting, proper documentation must be maintained. This documentation should include as much information as possible about the problem encountered, steps taken to determine the cause of the problem, steps to correct the problem and ensure it will not reoccur, and steps that did not solve the problem, because then future technicians or you will remember if anything has been changed, and can change it back. If, say, you're troubleshooting a network problem and you set it to manual IP and you enter an IP on a computer, well, then if something with the DNS or the IP goes wrong, the next technician will know that it's set to a manual IP and they can probably solve the problem in about 5 seconds as opposed to 2 hours. There's a picture of a man sitting in front of a computer and a speech bubble. The network is down. If this problem persists, contact your administrator. Does anyone have any questions?
Just a comment. I hate that dialogue.
Yes. Same here. My network was down for almost maybe a week and a bit more a while ago, and that was very inconvenient. It took me a couple of days to realize that it wasn't me, it was the hardware in question, because it didn't occur to me to check the network lights until later on, and I found out that it was the only one that was on was a flashing red one, a red one anyway, so I knew that the router had finally given up its meager ghost. So the next section would be gathering information. Once the problem is confirmed, the first step is to gather information. Usually the best way to do this is to question the individual who reported the problem as well as any other affected users. Questions can include end-user experiences, observed symptoms, error messages, and information about recent configuration changes to devices or applications. Next, collect any information about any equipment that may be affected. This can be gathered from documentation. Any log files and a list of recent changes to any equipment, plus people's troubleshooting steps, is also necessary. Other information on the equipment includes the manufacturer, make and model, as well as ownership and warranty information. So, just in case something has to be repaired, you know the best option to repair it. The version of any firmware or software on the device is also important, because there may be compatibility problems with particular hardware. There are some network monitoring tools that can gather information about equipment. These are complex applications often used on large networks to continually gather information about the state of the network and network devices. These tools may not be available for smaller networks. Routers, web interfaces are examples of documentation resources, and most people with a wireless router have these available. They can log on and see information about their router, like the IP address and usually uptime and things like that, and firmware version. So once all necessary information is gathered, start the troubleshooting process. There's a checklist of troubleshooting items: nature of problem, end-user report, problem verification report, equipment manufacturer, make model, firmware version, basically the same thing we just covered, configuration and topology, which is another useful fact. It's good to know how the network is set up. That, logical topology is one of the is a star, and logical topology is something else, then that could cause or. So, does anybody have any questions about that?
I do have a comment. When you're going through the troubleshooting process, you're doing your documentation, and once eventually you're going to get into the research part of it to try and figure things out. Try and keep as much of the research as you can available, because you could run into situations where you don't have access to the internet. So it's always good to keep various software or other documentation on like a flash drive or a CD. And that way it's easily accessible whether you have the internet available or not.
That's true. I'm just thinking about all the invaluable resources, well, and large haystacks with needles in them that are forums for different devices, like my router that just died. If I had thought to look in the forums, it might have given me an opportunity to fix it if I'd actually had the capability to check through all the forms regarding that. But mind you, being the manufacturer of router, it's probably good that I got a replacement anyway. And this is one of the ones for TVs, so it's probably a better fit. But forums are good, and I'm just thinking of various scripts and such which might allow people to download the day's batch of forum posts on hardware and software, because sometimes they can provide as much information or more information in cases as the manual as in how to fix problems, because manual hasn't come up with yet. So the next section would be approaches to troubleshooting. All of the structured approaches to troubleshooting assume a layered concept of networking, such as the OSI model, in which every function of communication is broken down into 7 distinct layers. Of course, we went over those before. I hope a lot of people are pleased not throwing sausage pizza away. A troubleshooter can verify functionality at each layer until the problem is located and isolated. There are several different structured troubleshooting techniques available. Can anybody think of any?
Top down.
Okay, so we got the top down. Yep. Which would start from the top and work down of the model. Bottom up, which would do the opposite. Divide and conquer. Then there are more advanced ones, such as trial and error and substitution. So top-down starts with the application layer, what's on the screen, and works down and looks at the problem from the point of view of the user in the application. So is it just one application that's not functioning? Is it just Thunderbird that's doing weird things with my emails? Or will Outlook Express do the same thing, or Eudora, or whatever? Can the user access various web pages, but not email? Do other workstations have similar issues? Bottom up starts with the physical layer and works upwards. So the physical layer is concerned with hardware and wire connections. So if my email wasn't working, I'd check to see if the cable was unplugged, although the email would probably be the best scenario for top down. So and another component of the hardware layer is what I found on my router and forgot to check. I went from the top down approach, unfortunately, to my router, which was the wrong way to go. Are the lights working properly? That would have been a good thing to divide and conquer typically begins troubleshooting at one of the middle layers and works up or down. For example, the troubleshooting may begin at the network layer by verifying IP configuration. The structure of these approaches makes them ideally suited for the novice troubleshooter. More experienced individuals often bypass the structured approaches and rely on instinct and experience. They may use less structured techniques such as trial and error or substitution. So there's some diagrams, one of which depicts the OSI network model. Anybody give the the seven components of the OSI model?
From which direction? Does it matter?
Well, from the top, as the book goes.
Application. Okay, I don't know this as well as I thought I did.
Presentation.
Session? No.
Yeah, you guys have it right so far.
You got it, yep. You're alternating them pretty well.
Transport?
Yep.
I would have said network.
Yeah, that was next.
That's right, that comes after transport.
Data link.
And physical.
Perfect. You guys are great. Yes, so just remember, all people studying this need drastic psychotherapy. And you've got the model down. Now, of course, the diagram has the application, presentation, and session layers grouped together in one box that sort of show what the other network model is, too. The diagram gives summaries of the troubleshooting steps. Thinking of the bottom-up troubleshooting approach, what cases do you think it would be best suited for?
Where the whole network just isn't working, like, where you just can't get anything. That's all right.
Yeah, if multiple end users report the networks out, then yeah, the bottom-up would probably be the best situation. What do you think are some disadvantages of the bottom-up troubleshooting method?
I suppose you can spend a lot of time checking things which don't need to be, like, if it's only your email that's not working and you can still get internet, you can still open Internet Explorer and get web pages and stuff, there's possibly no point checking, like, cabling.
True. Yeah, if multiple users report that their email's down and a technician decides to go bottom up, then that's a lot of time wasted.
This actually will apply to either top down or bottom up. In some of these situations, because it will waste time either way if you go top-down or bottom-up, and you're going the wrong direction to troubleshoot.
Well, yeah, and like I did, like I said, spending a bit of time going from the top-down and trying to fix my network, and when I should have just looked at the lights, that would have solved the problem right away. I guess it really depends on how experienced you are at knowing what could be the problem or which way you decide to go if it starts happening. I guess it depends on the first decision you make and the first guess you make as to what the problem might be. And there's the divide and conquer. We pretty much covered top down as well. So there's the divide and conquer troubleshooting approach, which starts at the data link, for example, networker, and moves up or down depending on the circumstances, which is then most suitable when the technician is experienced and the problem has precise symptoms. And it while the technician needs a bit of experience to know the system, to know where the problem could be, it can be a lot faster than the other approaches because you save.
Your what? Sorry, your thing unkeyed.
Ah, sorry. You You save time by using the divide and conquer troubleshoot approach if you experience with the system and with what could probably is more likely to be the right cause of the problem. For the more experienced technicians, the other troubleshooting approaches would be trial and error and substitution. Trial and error would rely on individual knowledge to determine the most common cause of the problem. So if I had checked the internet and various email clients and I knew and I figured for sure it was the router and I had it available, then the next step would be I would try substituting the router, and if that worked, well, I would have solved my problem. Although that would have been the first step I'd tried. Well, that's more of a substitution technique, but it could be trial and error if the first thing you try is to replace a piece of hardware, or then trial and error would continue until the technician has ruled out all the improper causes and found the right one. Does anybody have any questions?
Let me throw out an interesting situation real quick.
Sure.
I just got a laptop here in the last week, and the girl says, okay, it's running slow, and there's some times where I can't log into my system. It's Windows XP. There's some times where it'll get up to the login screen, sometimes it won't. So, trial and error. First thing I think of, it's a virus. Well, there were a couple viruses on the hard drive, but that wasn't the only problem she had. There were a couple more, and it turns out that the virus scan kept freezing it, like, anywhere between half and 60%, and I ran Malwarebytes to see about scanning for spyware, and that froze. So immediately, anybody want to take a guess at the next thing that I tried?
I'm out of this because you've already whinged to me about it.
Tried another virus scanner, or put the hard drive in another computer.
Well, yeah, I already talked to Luke about this one. The next thing I tried, since it kept freezing on both of those, I said, "Well, let me do a check disk." And it turns out that there were quite a number of bad clusters on the hard drive, and I actually have a cooling pad here on my laptop, which I unplugged so I could actually hear the hard drive. And it was doing this little tick, tick thing. So between the bad clusters and the fact that it was doing this little tick thing, I kind of figured that her hard drive's crashed or getting ready to. So she has a new hard drive, and it is in the process of restoring right now.
How did you do that? Did you just rebuild the machine from the ground up sort of thing, or did you image the drive and then restore it across somehow?
I got a restore CD this afternoon. Put the new hard drive in and ran the restore CD.
Install the OS and yeah.
Ah, so her drive isn't restored, just the basic OS and things. That definitely is one for trial and error. That's a good way of solving the problem. And without your experience, I mean, like I said, I would have tried different approaches and probably spent a lot more time and gotten a lot more frustrated. So everyone has different experiences in solving the problem. And so with the substitution method, which I kind of went over along with the trial and error, usually a part that's assumed to be the problem is replaced. I mean, the ISP that I dealt with didn't bother to send someone out to look at my router. They just said, here, we'll send you a new one, throw your old one out. And fortunately that solved the problem. Well, I think probably the light had something to do with it, but that solved the problem quite quickly. And of course, in typical Discovery fashion, there's a picture of this illustrating a woman who's just installed a new or a placement laptop to save time and quickly restore network functionality. And now we have an activity. This is 9.1.3 troubleshooting techniques. So there's a bunch of scenarios, and we have the troubleshooting techniques of divide and conquer, bottom up, substitution, and trial and error. We have different scenarios, and we have to choose which technique is best. Is everybody in chat?
Yep.
Looks like it.
What's that?
I said it looks like it.
Apparently, yep. Okay, so you've got the four troubleshooting techniques, and so that the first scenario, Racine is troubleshooting a network connectivity problem. She starts her investigation at the physical medium by checking cable connections and slowly works her way up through the layered network to the application software. And so what do you think that would be? That would be right. Bottom up. Medhat is unable to connect to a site on the internet. In troubleshooting, he first tests network connectivity. If that fails, he'll work his way down the layers to the physical medium. If the network connectivity tests succeed, he'll work his way up to troubleshooting the application layer. Which would that be? Seems to be the most sensible course there. So Patty is troubleshooting an issue on the network. Based on her past experience, she assumes the problem is a bad IP configuration and starts troubleshooting with that. Which one would that be? Yeah, she's going with her first hunch and seeing if that'll fix the problem. And the last one, which by process of elimination would be substitution. Alan calls the ISP, complaining of issues connecting to the internet. The ISP sends a new reconfigured modem to Alan in hopes that it solves the situation. I'm just refocusing. What was that, Brian?
There's an interesting thing to substitution, though. Although it does solve the problem, there's always that possibility that, you know, the problem could end up reoccurring, and if you just substitute out something good that you know works for something that doesn't, yes, that solves the problem, but then you really don't know where the problem occurred a lot of times. And if it happens again, then you end up having to substitute out again. So it could waste a little bit of resources too to do that way.
That's true. It could be a band-aid solution. I mean, I have no idea why my two-wire router just decided to become a no-wire and a nice big fancy paperweight. It could have been something inside the router, but it could have been something to do with like a mini power surge or something that didn't affect anything but that. So substitution is more of a band-aid solution unless you take a look at the affected component and realize what the actual problem was. Afterwards, you really have to take time to identify the problem. I mean, yeah, you could get things working, but if you have the knowledge, checking to see what...
Substitution is great for cables, for a quick video card, because then at least you can rule out that component. That's what substitution's for, to rule out a bad component.
That's true. And, I mean, as we all know how to make crossover cables...
solution to it, though, doesn't it?
Yeah,
but at least you know what's wrong.
At least you know exactly where the problem is. You know that it's, you know, in the router and not in the cable. I mean, If I had more network cables, I would have probably wasted more time replacing the cables until I realized, oh, I should check the lights on this thing. If I had the knowledge, I would have opened the two-wire and looked at the mess of circuits and things inside to try to figure out what exactly had broken and why. It's a very handy way of, if not completely preventing, at least isolating the problem for next time. Of course, we all know how to make crossover cables, so if we have a bad cable, maybe we can just rebuild it. I don't know if shorts are physically apparent, but we can...
If you can see, they are, and we don't usually build cables as blind people.
Oh, it's true. It could be a little bit of an issue. Now there's... The next section will be troubleshooting issues and detecting physical problems. A large proportion of networking problems are related to physical components, problems with the physical layer. Unplugged cables, bad wires, bad routers. Physical problems are concerned mainly with the hardware aspects of computers and the logical software configuration of devices. Physical problems can occur in both wired and wireless networks. One of the best detection methods for physical problems is the senses, vision, smell, touch, and hearing. Picture of all the organs in question, eyes, nose, hands, and ears. So the sense of sight, when present, is used to detect problems such as improperly connected or poorly constructed cables, including cables which aren't connected, connected to the wrong port, loose cable connections, damaged cables, the wrong connectors. Vision will also allow us to view the condition and function of various LEDs with a glance. Smell, which usually is more of a general alert sense, can alert troubleshooters to components which are overheating, or in some cases have overheating and they've already let the smoke out. The smell of burning insulation and components is very distinct and a sure sign that something is seriously wrong. Yeah, usually by the time you've smelt something, you know that you have of where what the problem is. Troubleshooters can use touch to feel for overheated components, as well as to detect mechanical problems with devices. If you're touching a computer and every half a second or so there's a vibration, maybe there's something that the fan's hitting and causing to shake. It can also sometimes detect whether a hard drive is moving on a small enough device, although that's more usually for sound. So, what kinds of problems do you think the sense of hearing can detect?
Overheating, again, to a point?
To a point, although I suppose...
As in, where I'm going with that is, if your fans are just constantly screaming away, and it's not getting any cooler, then maybe...
Yeah, no, that's true. That's definitely a good indication. Probably want to take the device and blow some air through it to try to blow out some of the dust that's most likely in there. Or turn the heating down if it's the temperature. If you have an AM radio, the hearing can replace a lot of the other senses as well. It can replace sight as well, because you can tell the correct operation of certain devices by hearing the... Hold it up to your router and it's not making its proper sounds, then maybe there's something wrong or something else is interfering, but at least you have an idea. Any change from the normal sounds usually indicates a problem. So if there's... Come to think of it, with my router, I actually heard a very high-pitched, very quiet whine, which... other people couldn't, but if I had my ear close enough, I could actually hear it, which probably means that there was some circuit that was bleeding power into something or other. And there are some software utilities for troubleshooting connectivity. Most of the there are a number of utilities which can help identify problems. Most of these utilities are provided by the operating system and used as command line commands. What do you think some of the utilities to help with network connectivity would be?
Like ping,
IP config.
For more advanced troubleshooting methods, you've got traceroute or traceRT, which displays the exact connection to a website. So if all the sites but one are working, you can use traceroute to see where all your packets are going and how long it takes to get there. And if your computer's internet is slow, for example, netstat would be a good one. It would display all the internet or all the connections, all the devices connected to your computer, and all the, not just devices, but all the software connections your computer's making. So if you try to load a web page and it takes 5 minutes, you might check netstat, and if you realize that that torrent program you thought you shut down has about 60 connections open, then well, you know where that's coming from. There's DNS lookup. Queries the name server for information on a destination domain. So if something's if a website's not directing like you think it should, you can use DNS lookup and find out things. Of course, there's pictures of these. The IP, there's five computers, and each one is using one of the. So IP config is asking, do I have the right IP address and subnet mask? And computer 2 would be ping, and the question would be, can I send an IP packet to another host? Miss Netstat would be asking, what are my active network connections, and which TCP or UDP ports are in use? What route will my packets take to another host, and how much delay will there be at each hop? And Mr. DNS Lookup asks, answers, what is the IP address of www.xx.com? So, issuing IP config, as we probably know from previous, will display the basic information including IP address, subnet mask, and default gateway. IP config slash all will display the MAC address, IP addresses of default gateway and DNS servers, and it also shows what internet connections the computer possesses and whether they're actually connected. And if DHCP is enabled, so if you're troubleshooting with ipconfig, it's best to use ipconfig slash all, and that'll give you a whole lot of information at once. So without a proper IP configuration, the host can't participate in the network. DNS servers, well, it won't know how to get the names for websites. Ipconfig release and renew will, well, release and renew the IP. the IP information, if it's assigned dynamically, it'll release the current DHCP bindings, and the IP config slash renew will request fresh configuration info from the DHCP server. If the problem is software network based, if sites can't, the hardware layers are okay. Sometimes repopping the IP configuration would quickly solve the problem. Does questions?
No.
So it seems IP configuration is the best part of the divide and conquer troubleshooting method to try, because you know very quickly if the problem is hardware or application based. Picture of the screenshot of the Windows command prompt showing IP configuration information from the IP install command. So if the IP configuration appears to be correct, the next thing to test would be connection to a host with the ping command. Ping will test if a specific host is reachable. So for example, if your email seems to be sluggish and you can't connect to qcat.org, you might ping the website and see if it's up to know if actually receiving packets, or if your network is, if you're not able to connect to actual websites. I use it almost every day when my roommate accuses me of slowing down our network. I'll show him by pinging one site, usually Google, and usually the time lag is about 27 milliseconds. Then I'll ping his TV site and show him how the time lag is about 100 milliseconds and go, see, this time I'm not causing the problem, it's the site's fault. And ping would then be followed by the name, by an IP address or the name of a destination host. So you could ping .7.5 to test one of the computers on your local network. www.cisco.com to test a website on the internet. When a ping is sent to an IP address, a packet known as an echo request is sent across the network to an IP address specified. If the destination host receives the echo request, it responds with a packet known as an echo reply. If the source receives the echo reply, connectivity is verified. So let's say we send a ping to a name such as cisco.com. First, a packet is sent to a DNS server to resolve the name into an IP address. That's why on the ping command, when you type it, you'll see ping the website and then an IP. For example, for Google, you might see, you type in ping www.google.com, the next line will say pinging www.l.google.com, and then it will give a long IP address. It's because the l.google.com is the correct name associated with the IP address, so the site spits back the correct name and an IP to ping. And once the correct address is obtained, the echo request is forwarded to that IP address, so you're actually pinging the IP address of Google. If the ping to the IP address succeeds, but the ping to the name does not, then there's most likely a problem with the DNS server. And there's, of course, a picture of the ping succeeding. Pings to the IP address and name are successful. The problem most likely resides in the application on the destination host. For example, the requested service may not be running. So if you send a mail to Hotmail and pings of the web address and IP address are successful, the problem is somewhere on the bay where your email account is stored, most likely. If neither ping is successful, then the problem most likely occurs along the network path to the destination. And so the first troubleshooting step would then be to ping the default gateway to make sure that you send a packet from your computer to your gateway to the internet. If ping to the default gateway fails, then the problem probably resides in the local machine or the connection to the gateway. The ping command can be modified from its default of 4 echoes, or echo requests, to 30. Diagram displaying the screenshot of the Windows help command, which would be found at ping /?. It would list all the info. Of course, the next section is trace router, trace RT. So if a device can't ping a destination, ping utility won't tell you where the connection was dropped. So if you're able to ping the default gateway but you can't ping the site, you can use trace RT to find out exactly what the best path to that device is and where the connection might be having some problems. The trace RT utility will provide information on every router along the path used to connect to a destination. It also indicates the time to get to each hop. So if, for example, I ping Google, tell me exactly how long it would take to make up those 27 or 20 milliseconds to get back and forth from each individual hop, different router to me. Point out exactly where packets are lost due to slowdowns in the network. You can adjust the basic default of 30 hops before TraceRT assumes that a destination is unreachable, and you can adjust this with the -h, I should say. Questions or comments? Assuming not, I will just pause for a couple minutes to 1 minute to...
Yeah, I'm good so far.
And so there are other modifiers for the TraceRT command. And, of course, there's a picture describing these, which you can get to by typing TraceRT/?. Now, netstat will, as I've said, let you know what connections are connected to, or yeah, which connections are being made to your computer, incoming or outgoing. Netstat is an important can be used to verify all the connections, and can be quite important sometimes to know what exactly is coming into your computer or going out of it. It will list the... Can anybody give an idea of what netstat might actually list?
Isn't it mostly, like, usage statistics and things? Like, kind of what connection's actually done what type of stuff?
Well, it'll use...
If I understood what you said correctly before.
Okay.
I don't know, I'm guessing, but...
Well, it lists the protocol in use, the local address and port number, the port, the foreign address and port number, and the state of the connection. Unexplained TCP connections can pose a major security threat, and this is because they can indicate that someone is connected to the local host. Additionally, they can consume valuable system resources and slowing down the network. So, one thing I would consider if my network is running fine and I'm getting 20 milliseconds to Google, and my roommate's TV site is running fine, I would probably suggest that he do a netstat and figure out what's connected to his computer. If he's downloading something, or if he's closed all the programs to stream TV, then and he suddenly notices that he has a bunch of active connections, then there might be some problems on his computer, some spyware or something else that could be slowing down his bandwidth. Of course, the help for netstat can be found at netstat/?. Now, DNS lookup will show information about the DNS servers and the DNS name. If you're trying to get to a website instead of actually giving the long IP address, which could change, you might enter a website. So, for example, instead of memorizing qcat.org's IP address, which the ISP could change if they felt like it, you just enter qcat.org, and the DNS server looks it up for you and says, "Okay, that's at this IP today," and gives the web browser the proper IP to go to. The DNS utility will allow an end user to look up information about the particular DNS name on the DNS server. The DNS lookup command is issued, the information returned includes the IP address of the DNS server being used, as well as the IP address associated with the specified DNS name. So if you were to type in qcat.org and you got a website on free body part enlargement supplies, then you would check with the DNS you'd maybe check DNS lookup to see if the if there's a redirector on your computer, or what DNS server is actually being used, to check with your to look up information. Here's a picture of a small network, a local client, a DNS server, which is test.svr.example.com. There's an IP address and another machine with the cisco.netacad.net and another IP address. Local client sends a request to the DNS server, receives the DNS IP and the IP for cisco.netacad.net, and then uses the IP 209.165.200.224 to package the information. That would be how the DNS process works. We'll receive, when the user does a DNS lookup, they receive an IP address for cisco.netacad.net as the previous IP, a non-authoritative answer. And this, and with that and the IP address of the DNS server, they can determine which DNS server is being used with the name. Does anybody have any questions about the troubleshooting tools? Okay, so next we have connectivity issues. Connectivity problems will occur on any type of networks, wired or wireless, or even networks that use both. When troubleshooting a network with both wired and wireless connections, it's often best to troubleshoot using a divide and conquer technique to isolate the problem. When my router died, the first thing I knew was my roommate came up to me and said, "The internet isn't working again." So I stopped what I was doing and I tried to ping a local ping a website and didn't get any answer. So I checked the cable, because he's connected wirelessly and I'm not, so I checked the cable to the router and the cable to the wall and pinged the website again, and no luck. And then after too long of trying other techniques, I figured I'd try the network lights, so I turned on the router and noticed there was a red light above the power switch. Figured that was a problem and that I should replace the modem. So since he couldn't get to the default gateway at all, I tried pinging from the default gateway. This was to verify if a wired client was connecting as expected. If I had been able to ping from the gateway, then I would have had to see whether his computer was actually the problem, or whether whether another device could connect. So I would have probably connected my iPhone to the network and checked to see if that worked. And if it didn't, then I would have realized the problem led with the wireless network. Another step to try is ping from a wireless client to a wired client, and this would verify if the network was functioning as expected and packets could be sent from one device to another. There's a picture of a wireless and wired host connected to a router, and which is connected to a modem, which goes to the ISP. And there's pictures of people pinging between the router and the hosts and out to the network. Of course, one of the first steps, which I should have tried first, would be to check the indicators on the routers and computers. I mean, if his network had not worked and we knew where the wireless light on his computer was, it would have been good to check that and see if his wireless was on or off, and then we could have gone from there, tried figuring out the information to turn it back on. The exact configuration of LEDs which convey information varied between manufacturers and devices. There's three types of LEDs commonly found on devices: power, status, and activity. On some devices, such as mine, a single LED may contain multiple pieces of information. So, for example, usually when I turned the router on, it was supposed to turn, the light was supposed to turn green, and that would show both that the router had power and that there was no hardware failure. In my case, when there was a problem, it was red. So it showed that there was a solid red light, so it showed that there was hardware failure that couldn't be overcome. It's very important to check the equipment documentation for the exact meaning of all indicators. In my case, my documentation was the tech support guy on the other end of the phone, who I told, yeah, it's a solid red light, can I fix it? And he said no, that I would have to replace it. Sometimes there's lights above every port, and inactive LEDs may be an indication of a device failure or cabling issues. Also, occasionally, lights will blink at the speed of data going through, so you can tell if it's 2 or 10 or 20 flashes a second how fast the data is going through. So you'll want to, if you verify whether the device and all the ports are functional, that'll save a lot of time in solving problems, and also probably tell you roughly where the problem is. If all the ports are functioning and you can ping from one port, you know it's probably not the LAN ports, it's probably something to do with the wireless or the internet. And there's a diagram displaying the Linksys router. WRT300 and it shows all the lights that are available as an example of the lights on a router. You've got security LED, which indicates the current condition of security settings on the device. Solid green indicates security is enabled. So if you've set all the security settings up properly and the light changes from green, you know that something's been changed. Maybe someone's reset the router, or somebody's logged in and changed something without letting you know. There's activity LEDs, wireless, internet, and Ethernet. These are sometimes referred to as link lights. Normally an activity LED is associated with a specific port. They'll flash showing that traffic is flowing through the port. On the Linksys, solid green indicates that a device is plugged into the port, but no traffic is flowing. Flashing green indicates that the device is connected and receiving traffic. So if my roommate's connect computer would be was the only one connected, and I know, and he said that his wireless was dead. We could check the link light, and we could see if there was actually a connection, if it was green or if it was not. Amber indicates the device is making adjustments to the way the port is operating. So if we saw it stayed amber for a while, we'd think that his computer was doing something to the port. No light indicates that nothing's plugged into the port, or there's an issue with the connection. But again, exact meaning of colors may vary according to manufacturers. So it's good to know. Good to have the documentation for your specific device. Of course, the power LED. No light indicates a problem with the power. And in my case, red light indicates, well, a hardware failure. So that there was still power getting to the light to turn it red, but something was broken inside the router. There's some connectivity problems. If a wired client cannot connect to a router, one of the first things to check would be the physical connectivity. Cabling is the central nervous system of wired networks, and one of the most common issues when experiencing inactivity. There are several issues to watch for in cabling, including improper cable termination. They should be terminated according to the termination standards. The 568A or 568B termination standard. And you don't want to termination to so that the information can flow properly. And make sure to crimp connectors on the cable jacket to provide strain relief. Cable run lengths. The cable run lengths exist based on characteristics of the different cables. Exceeding these run lengths can have a serious impact on network performance. For example, when I used to work in tech support, the telephone cables were only allowed to be 10 feet from the wall. If your cable was any more than 10 feet long, even if it was within 10 feet, but the cable itself was 20, then the electricity had a long way to travel and would probably lose too much. The cable would probably lose too much energy to send the information properly, and there could be network issues. So I would always suggest the customer try a shorter cable. You will also want to verify the correct ports are being used between devices. Sure that the cable from the computer is plugged into an active port on the router and not the WAN port, which I've done before. Not knowing which was which, I plugged into the wrong. You want to protect cables and connectors from physical jammers. You want to support cables to prevent strain on connectors and run cable through areas that will not be in the way. Also, things like the Tunker protectors, as they're named, are little hoods that go over the levers to make sure the levers don't fall out of the cable, so it's not too hard to remove. They need to change it. A picture of a Cisco switch with multiple cables plugged into it to show different computers connected, and of course you want to make sure all the cables are sorted properly. With the wireless network, or the WLAN, their equivalent to cable would be radio problems. So if a wireless host can't connect to the access point, there may be wireless connectivity problems. Wireless communications rely on radio frequencies, signals, or RF, to carry data. Many factors can affect our ability to connect hosts, or to hosts. I have a friend who it took us a long time to finally troubleshoot. In fact, it took me even partway through the discovery course until the penny dropped to realize, hey, his phone and his treadmill are interfering with his network because of his wireless signal. Of course, funnily enough, now that we changed the router, his phone is still interfering with his network. I think that might be a problem with his DSL filters, and I plan to check and test that out if I get over there next. Some of the problems are wireless standards, because not all wireless standards are compatible. The 802.11a 5 GHz band is not compatible with the 802.11b, g, or n standards, which are on the 2.4 GHz band. Within that band, each standard uses different technology. Unless specifically configured, equipment that conforms to one standard may not function with that conforming to another. Then there's the channel problem. Each wireless conversation must occur on a separate channel, and they can't overlap. Some access points can be configured to use the least congested or highest throughput channel. Manual setting provides some greater control than the automatic settings may be necessary in some environments. If you have two wireless networks, one might by default use channel 11, so you might use channel 10 or 13 to connect to the router, or another network to ensure that the connections are separate. So the strength of a radio frequency signal decreases with distance. If the strength is too low, devices will be unable to reliably associate and move data. I'm noticing with my iTunes wireless sync that sometimes my room's at the other opposite end of the house to the computer, so sometimes I'll notice that the computer will be able to sync properly, and sometimes it'll stop in the middle of a sync for no good reason, and fail to start until I actually go down and physically connect the two devices. And because the interference is too low, I'm thinking of getting some type of booster to help raise that. The utility for configuring the network card can be used to display the signal strength and connection quality. Outside sources can also interfere with RF signals. The devices functioning on the same frequency and other machinery, period. A site survey should be used to detect for this. APs also share the available bandwidth between more devices. As more devices associate with the access point, the bandwidth for each individual device will decrease, causing network performance problems. Solution would be to reduce the number of clients using each channel. So if you notice that your wired connection is slow, one of the first things you can do is see if there are too many wireless devices connecting and hogging your bandwidth. A picture of the Linksys WRT300N router with the wireless settings. Does anybody have any questions so far? Anyone that hasn't run away or is still awake? Nice. Would assume not then. So this is of course that. Are you still here, Sam? Okay.
Right, still here and no questions.
Glad I didn't bore someone to tears. Okay. Well, so taking a look at the Linksys router. This, of course, is just an example of a router settings page. The wireless basic wireless settings tab is selected, and the following settings are configured. Network mode is mixed, which would be then the of which which wireless standard it supports. Name is, well, the SSID would be Cisco or whatever you choose. That would be the name that's displayed to devices when they want to connect to your network. A colleague was looking at wireless networks and saw one labeled connect or die, or connect and die, and it was secured, so he couldn't connect to it, but hadn't been secured, he would have been able to connect. Radio band is auto. That would be to choose the best channel. The wide and standard channels are auto. SSID broadcast enabled. This would mean that the SSID, the network name, is actually being broadcast. If the connect and die person really wanted to make their network secure and unconnectable, they would have turned off SSID broadcast, and only the people that knew of the network name could type it. Would have to type it in when they manually created a wireless profile and connect that way. There are wireless configuration problems. Modern WLANs incorporate various technologies to help secure the data. Incorrect configuration of these can prevent communication. Some of the most common settings that are configured incorrectly: SSID, authentication, and the encryption. So the SSID must match on both the access point and the client. And that's an alphanumeric string. It's case sensitive, up to 32 characters. Again, that's the network name. SSID is not broadcast. It must be manually entered into the client. If the client is configured with the wrong SSID, it will not associate. If I had not broadcast my SSID and manually configured all my devices, and then when I plugged in the new router had messed up the capitalization, well, the clients couldn't connect until I fixed them. And if another access point is present and broadcasting the SSID, the client may automatically associate to that, which is a good reason why to change your default SSID, because if two people in the neighborhood have a Linksys routers and both are set to Linksys, then then your computers will be very confused as to which one to pick. You want to change your SSID to something like, you know, this is the house I'm in, or something similar. On most access points, open authentication is all devices to connect. If a more secure form of authentication is configured, a key is necessary. Well, in my experience, most routers that I've come across require a key. Scares involving people finding open networks and downloading things they shouldn't be, getting the network admins in trouble, and people stealing bandwidth. Lots of the network owners around have taken to securing their networks. I did after a stalker threatened to war drive my roommate's connection. Of course, if necessary, both the client and access point must be configured with the same key. If the keys don't, communication will fail and the devices will not associate. Encryption is the process of altering data so it's not usable by anyone without the proper encryption key. If encryption is enabled, the same encryption key must be configured on both the access point and the client. If the client does associate but can't send or receive data, the encryption key could be a problem. And then there's more generally there's DHCP issues. If the physical connection to the host appears to be connecting as expected, you can check the IP configuration of the client. The IP configuration can have a major impact of the ability of a host to connect to the network. So for my netbook, after doing the chapter 3 lab on crossover cables. I had it connected to a previous desktop by the Ethernet connection with a crossover cable. When I wanted to connect the network to another internet connection, I wondered why, to my horror, it wasn't working. And then I realized that I had forgotten to remove the static IP settings I used while connecting to the crossover cable. So I had to remove those, and my network worked fine because I'd never used the Ethernet in my network except for those two occasions. The HCP server for local wired and wireless clients and provides IP configuration and the IP address subnet mask default gateway DNS servers. I've known that checking in the homepage of my router finds the IP addresses of the TELUS DNS servers it uses. And unless I configure my computers to use something like OpenDNS, they're going to be TELUS servers. The DHCP servers will binds the IP address to a client's MAC address and stores that information in a client table. HomeLinksys wireless router, for example, this table can be examined through the status local network page in the GUI. This is why different computers keep getting different IP addresses. The client table information should match the local host information. Of course, the IP address of the client must be on the same network as the LAN interface of the device. The LAN interface of the router should be set as the client's default gateway. For example, most routers, or typically a router might have an IP address of 192.168.1.0, and all the other computers on the router will have IP addresses from 192.168.1. The first four on a standard wired are the standard wired connections on an integrated router, and the next group are wireless, which can allow a lot of connections. In my ISP's integrated router, the last number for the router's address was 254, and of course, if the information, client information, does not agree with the client table, then the address should be released and renewed. So if both the wired and wireless clients are containing the correct IP configuration and can connect to the device, but are unable to ping each other, problem is most likely occurring on the device. Maybe there's a problem with the network stack or something. So check all configurations on the device to ensure no security restrictions could be causing the issue. It could be that someone set up network restrictions to prevent computers from talking to each other or sending bad things back and forth. If that's the case, well, you can undo the restrictions and see if that allows the computers to connect more freely. And now we have an activity. Identify which part of the network, wired, wireless, or both, is associated with each scenario. So, does anybody have any questions first?
Not for me.
So, okay. So, assuming none, then the parts of the network again are wired, wireless, or both, and we have to identify which is associated with each scenario. So, number one, improperly configured SSID. Which part of the network would that be? And so the next one would be improperly configured addressing. Yep, both could cause both improper addresses. Now, ability to ping from station to wired host. Well, it correctly says STA to wired host, but yes, the answer would be both. Disconnected Ethernet port. on access point. The questions aren't exactly clear because yes, although the AP can throw you off, but yes, the Ethernet port wouldn't really cause an issue with the wireless connectivity. It would be to do with the wired problem. It would be causing a wired problem. Improperly configured channel. Yes, wired ports don't usually use channels. Not that I know of, anyway. Now, the wrong cable type used to connect to access point. Be right. Usually, wireless doesn't involve cables, so if somebody somehow manages to get a phone jack to an RJ11 cable, which is a phone cable to stick in an RJ45 hole somehow, then there's probably something wrong in that case, the problem exists between keyboard and chair, but the problem would be on a wired network. And a defective cable used to connect to the access point or router. Absolutely. Unless, of course, they're talking about the power cable, which would then be both, but I don't think the text goes that far. That would be wired. Improperly configured web key. That would be it. Local or wired connections don't use keys, so it would be the wireless. And,
though it could be argued that anything wrong, that uses WEP is improperly configured these days anyway.
it could be. Entering other keys can be quite, for the couple of years that I lived with some roommates, I couldn't get my laptop onto the internet because they refused to go through the time and trouble of giving me the uppercase and lowercase gibberish of their very long network key. And the next question would be wrong 802.11 mode. Which would that be? If you have a device, if the computer is set to, yep, exactly, wireless. So now we're just about out of time, but we have a chapter quiz. Do you want to do the chapter quiz now, or refresh your knowledge on it next week? Well, I guess there isn't a next.
Chapter quiz is all matching, so I would not suggest doing it now.
Oh, you can.
No, that's true.
Which one? Do you want me to read it off for you guys? Is it in the Discovery, is it in the jetpack?
If it isn't, it can be.
How are you doing it? Do you have a copy with the answers and a copy with the questions? Or did you
consolidate it? I'm trying to find a copy with the answers right now.
We can work out the answers easily.
What's that, Brian?
Okay. Quiz answers are in the jetpack. I haven't opened them to see if the quiz itself is with them.
Oh, this is actually done well. This module 9 somebody did correctly, so you have all the answers in the right order and everything.
Yep, they're here.
That's what we're working on, the quiz, right?
Yes.
Okay, what question?
Have we done any questions?
What was that? Which question?
Which question are you
asking? No, we haven't done any questions yet.
Oh, okay, I thought you were talking about matching. I was like, I'll just read the match to you and show you how it works, but yeah. Okay.
Yeah, just do it,
okay,
Gracie.
So...
Or are you going to do it, Aiden? Because we're like 3 minutes off 11, let's get this quiz out of the way and finish this beastie up.
Okay, yeah, do you want to do it, Grace, then?
Does
have a braille
display. I have a braille display. I can shortcut you if you want. You can if you'd like, but
that
I can do it for you as well.
That you'd probably be faster.
Okay. Let
Oops,
me put myself on auto.
The wrong quiz. I was thinking of chapter 8 quiz, not 9. 8's more matching than this one.
And you wouldn't be able to do it unless you had the activities the right or the stuff the right way, which now we do, and we'll be up in Discovery's instructor area. Okay, am I audible? I think so. All right. Alright.
Yep.
Alright. A small office uses a wireless ISR to connect a cable modem for internet access. The network administrator receives... an office computer can't access external websites. The first troubleshooting step the administrator uses is to ping the ISR. What troubleshooting process does this represent? A. Top-down. B. Bottom-up. C. Substitution. D. Divide and conquer. Answer no. Oh, yeah, Lee signs in red as I'm reading.
Could you read the options again? Sorry.
A. Top-down. B. Bottom-up. C. Divide and conquer. D. C. Substitution. D. Divide and conquer.
Thank you.
Anyone?
Is anyone answering?
Okay.
Does anybody have any idea? What, does anybody know what a ping
does? It's our lecturer. Luke, why A?
Well, I thought about that after I said it, and I'd actually change that to B, because pinging is checking your, it's checking connections, so I would have said that's, you know, physical stuff.
No. D is divide and conquer.
No, I
what
said
level
D for
of
Bravo.
Right, D. It's divide and conquer. Ping is one of the middle layers.
Checking the cabling
physical
would be checking
is
the
going
actual
to be
physical
actually checking the cable.
Connections.
Is that cable broken? Pinging is actually checking stuff on the IP layer. Can this information travel?
Layer 3, if anybody remembers their layers, is ping. So you are dividing and conquering. You're starting in the middle.
Yeah, okay.
All right, guys. Which three items should be documented after a web server troubleshooting process when a web server has crashed? All right, so this is a yes or no. A, when the problem occurred. Absolutely, good job, guys. B, the dialogue with the user. That would be a no. The configuration of all network devices on the LAN at the time of the crash. No is right. I think you guys want to have a life for the next 2 years, because the configuration of all hosts on the LAN at the time of the crash. No, that's right. Steps that were performed to identify the cause of the problem. Absolutely. Steps that were performed that failed to identify the problem. Yes, absolutely, because that's just as important. Alright, a user calls the help desk to report a workstation problem. Which three questions would produce the most helpful information for troubleshooting? Choose three. So this is going to be a yes or no. First, if you received an error message, what was it? And if you were lucky enough to have a user that can answer that question, then consider your day awesome. But yes, that's correct. Have there been any changes to your workstation lately?
No kidding.
Absolutely. Do you have the warranty for your workstation? And it's actually written exactly like that. No. What version of operating system?
That's a good way to scare your user.
Yeah. What version of your operating system is running on your workstation? Yes. And the final question that I'd just like to put in is, what did you break? Never ask that question.
Once when I was starting tech support, I started the call by asking, what's your issue? My quality coach was very quick to correct me.
What's
your issue?
Good.
Well, because when I started with a customer symptom, you know, note down the customer's issue. So I was without thinking.
What's your... Wow. A user wants to test...
Not quite as bad as what did you break, but close.
Yeah, pretty close. I think I would have answered, oh, I've got many. A user wants to test connectivity between host 3 and host 8 on a network. Which command can be used to verify connectivity? A. ipconfig. B. ping. C. netstat. D. nslookup. Choose now. B. Ping. Absolutely right. All right. Match the utility to the purpose. So our utilities are ping, netstat, traceroute, ipconfig, nslookup. So again, that is a ping, netstat, traceroute, ipconfig, and nslookup. Okay, so the first one displays IP settings on the host. Ipconfig, absolutely.
That was weird.
This one tests connections to other IP hosts. Ping, absolutely. This one asks, this one asks name server for info on destination host. NSLOOKUP. This one displays route taken to destination. Absolutely. And the last one displays network connections. NetStat. Good job, guys. Which three pieces of information are revealed by the ipconfig command? Choose three. A. Physical address. No. Not unless you do an ipconfig/all. Yes, it does, because I'm looking at why is there no star next to it? And I realized. Alright. How about the IP address? Absolutely. The DHCP server? No, it actually doesn't. That's another ipconfig/all1.
Again, with slash all it does.
Yes, it sure does. DNS server. Subnet mask? Absolutely. And default gateway. Okay, this is an important one for us blind people. How does an activity LED indicate that traffic is moving through a port? A. By flashing. B. By staying turned off. C. By staying a solid green color. D. By staying a solid amber color. Choose now. It actually flashes when traffic is moving through if it's a fancy schmancy one. What is one of the most common reasons why hosts could not be able to connect? What kind of a question is that? That is a grammatical nightmare. Okay, so why would a host not be able to connect? A. Operator error. B. Cabling problems. C. Equipment failure. D. Addressing problems.
Well, hang on, what was the answer to that other one first?
Cabling problems. Which, I don't like that question.
Yeah, it did say which is the most likely, and I mean, it's most likely that operator error wouldn't cause physical connections of hosts to break. I mean, unless the operators were monkeys that disconnected cables.
Which three factors can affect the ability of hosts to connect to known APs using radio frequency signals? Choose three. A. The RF strength increases with distance.
I wish.
Yeah, that'd be really cool. The 802.11a is not compatible with 802.11b/g standards. Anyone want to have a go? Yes, no? Yes. Yes, it is not compatible, so they won't connect. The available bandwidth between devices is shared with APs. Yes, actually. If you've got too many devices on an AP, one might not be able to connect.
Okay.
C. A wireless conversation must occur on multiple overlapping channels. No, that's right. Multiple devices running on the same frequencies cause interference. Yes. Okay, and this one I'm not even going to give you any choices for, because you should know the answer. What steps should be taken once a problem is resolved? Absolutely document it. And there is your quiz. And document that problem. Well, that's it, guys. That is the last module of Discovery, unless Brian and Aiden decide they want to do something else.